against my ribs. I drew soft and long breaths deep into my gut while Martin helped loosen my rib cage, trying to coax at least 50% diaphragmatic movement in each inhale and each exhale. Breathing this way wasn't necessary, Martin told me. Our bodies can survive on short and clipped breaths for decades, and many of us do. That doesn't mean it's good for us. Over time, the shallow breathing will cave in the lungs and can lead to high-shouldered and neck-extended posture common in those with emphysema, asthma, and other respiratory problems. Fixing this breathing and this posture is relatively easy. After several rounds of deep breaths into my open rib cage, Martin asked me to start counting from 1 to 10 over and over again with every exhale. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. At the end of the exhale, when I was so out of breath that I couldn't vocalize anymore, I was to keep counting, but to do so silently, letting my voice trail down to a sub-whisper. I ran through a few rounds, counting quickly and loudly, then silently. At the end of each breath, it felt like my chest had been plastic wrapped. "Keep going," Martin said. The strain of this counting exercise is equivalent to the strain on the lungs during physical exertion. That's what made it so effective for Stow's bedridden patients. The point was to get the diaphragm accustomed to this wider range so that deep and easy breathing became unconscious. A few more minutes of this counting silent and otherwise, and I felt my diaphragm chugging away like a piston in slow motion, radiating fresh blood from the center of my body. This is the feeling of what Stow called breathing coordination, when the amount of air that enters us equals the amount of air that leaves us, and our bodies are able to perform all their essential functions with the least exertion. In 1968, Stow left the VA system and his thriving private practice in New York to train yet another group of students. These people could talk, and they could walk, and they could run very fast. They were the members of the Yale track and field team, among the best in the nation at the time. When Stow arrived at the track field house, the athletes were so excited that they hung a poster on the bulletin board outside. It read, "Dr. Breath is here today." Stow had expected these elite athletes to have exemplary breathing habits. Instead, he found they suffered from the same problems as everybody else. They got the same colds, the same flus, and the same lung infections. Sprinters were the worst off. The short and violent breaths they took during runs put too much pressure on the delicate tissues of their lungs. As a result, they suffered from asthma and other respiratory ailments. At the finish line, many coughed or sometimes vomited or collapsed, wheezing in pain. The runners had been trained to push through the pain, and they did. They won competitions, but they were also killing their lungs. Stow laid out a table at the Yale indoor track, sat the runners on it, and began running his hands up and down their chests in front of a group of onlookers. After only a few sessions, all the runners reported feeling better and breathing better. "I never felt so relaxed in my life," one sprinter said. They took half the time to recover between races and were soon edging towards world records. On the heels of the Yale success, Stow moved to South Lake Tahoe to train runners preparing for the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico City. Same therapy, same success. A decathlete went on to break his previous record. Another broke his lifetime record. A runner named Rick Sloan broke 2 life records for 3 events. "Through my work with Dr. Stow, I knew I had to exhale," said Lee Evans. "You know, I exhale, which kept my energy up. I didn't get tired, but after the game, I found that this was for my life." You might recognize Evans. He's the man in the famous photograph standing on the center podium of the Olympics awards ceremony, wearing a Black Panther beret and jutting a fist in the air. He won gold in the 400 meters and another in the 400-meter relay. The rest of the 1968 U.S. men's team under Stow's training went on to win a total of 12 Olympic medals, most gold, and set 5 world records. It was one of the greatest performances in any Olympics. The Americans were the only runners to not use oxygen before or after the race, which was unheard of at the time. But they didn't need to. Stow had taught them the art of breathing coordination and the power of harnessing a full exhalation. "He was doing so many things at once," Lynn Martin said as we moved from the futon back to the dining room table at the center of her apartment. "The sensitivity of his hands, perfect pitch of his ears, the natural knack for instruction, all of it." For the past few minutes, Martin has been telling me about her time working with Stow, how she'd gone to see him in 1975 and had come out feeling transformed. She returned a few weeks later and took a job at the clinic. Even though she would spend more than 2 decades working with him as one of his closest associates, Stow never told her his secrets. "He thought it was too difficult to put into words," she told me. I could relate. I'd seen a video recording of Stow at the 1992 Aspen Music Festival, perhaps the only existing footage that demonstrates what he did and how he did it. Stow was at the center of a conference room, a massage table in front of him. An open window looked out over copses of pine trees glowing white in the summer sun. Stow was deeply tanned and dressed in a black blazer with brass buttons and a pocket kerchief, as if he'd just flown in on a Concorde from Monte Carlo. He started off by inviting a tenor singer to lie on the table and then proceeded to jiggle the man's jaw, dig his hands into his waist, and rock him back and forth. "You see, I have to keep tapping right on the chest," said Stow, his yellow polka dot tie dangling in the singer's hair. This went on for several minutes until Stow leaned 3 inches from the man's face and began to count from 1 to 10 with him in a gibberishy harmony. "Everything's loosening very fast," Stow announced. He wiggled the man's hips and neck so violently that the singer almost fell off the table. It was a bizarre spectacle, and the grabbing and pushing and deep stroking looked at times like borderline molestation. After my own experience in Martin's studio, babbling numbers and having my chest poked and my ribs squeezed, it became clear to me why Stow's work never caught on. It didn't matter that saxophonist David Sanborn, opera singers, Olympic runners, and thousands of other patients praised his treatments as a lifesaver. Stow wasn't a doctor. He was a self-made pulmonaut, a choir conductor. He was just too far out there. His methods were just too weird. Although the process of breathing involves both anatomy and physiology, neither branch of science has claimed it for thorough exploration, wrote Stow. It was a little-known territory waiting to be mapped and charted. Stow made his own map over a half-century of constant work, but when he died, that map was lost. As soon as he left the VA wards, so did his therapy. At the end of my 2-hour session with Martin, I walked down 45th Street and hopped a train back to the airport. As we rumbled across the marshlands and over the Passaic River, I searched through the current treatments for the nearly 4 million Americans now suffering from emphysema. There were bronchodilators, steroids, and antibiotics. There was supplemental oxygen and surgery and something called pulmonary rehabilitation, which included assistance in quitting smoking, exercise planning, and nutrition counseling. But there was no mention of Stow, or the second heart of the diaphragm, or the importance of a full exhalation. No mention of how expanding the lungs and breathing properly had effectively reversed the disease or lengthened lives. Emphysema was still listed as an incurable disease. Chapter 5. Slow. "Could you hand me the oximeter?" Olson asked from across the dining room table. It's afternoon on the 5th day of the recovery phase, and for the past 30 minutes, we've been testing our blood gases, heart rates, and other vital signs. This is the 45th time we've been through this drill in the past 2 weeks. Although both Olson and I feel utterly transformed while nasal breathing, the monotony of the days is becoming maddening. We're eating the same food at the same time as we did 10 days earlier, sweating through the same stationary bike workouts in the same gym, having many of the same conversations. This afternoon, we're discussing Olson's favorite subject, his obsession for the past decade. We are, once again, talking about carbon dioxide. It's hard to admit now, but when I first interviewed Olson more than a year ago, he was not a source I entirely trusted. On our Skype calls, he'd like to hammer the importance of slow breathing. Now, this part made sense to me, but when he started in on the restorative wonders of a toxic gas, I began to wonder. "I really think carbon dioxide is more important than oxygen," he told me. Olson claimed that we have 100 times more CO2 in our bodies than oxygen, which is true, and that most of us need even more of it, which is also true. He said it wasn't oxygen, but huge quantities of carbon dioxide that fostered the burst of life during the Cambrian explosion 500 million years ago. He said that today humans can increase this toxic gas in our bodies and sharpen our minds, burn fat, and heal disease. After a while, I began to worry that Olson was nuts, or at least prone to gross exaggeration, and that our hours and hours of conversations had been a total waste of time. Carbon dioxide, after all, is a metabolic waste product. It's the stuff that plumes out of coal plants and rotten fruit. Every other day, there's a new headline detailing how Earth was warming because there was too much CO2 in the atmosphere. Animals were dying. Carbon dioxide kills. Olson kept arguing the opposite. He insisted that CO2 could be beneficial, and he warned me that having too much oxygen in my body wouldn't help me, but hurt me. "Breathing heavy, breathing quickly and as deeply as you can, I realize this is the worst advice anyone could give you," Olson told me. Big, heavy breaths were bad for us because they depleted our bodies of, yes, carbon dioxide. Several months of this back and forth got me intrigued enough, or confused enough, or both, that I decided to fly to Sweden. My hope was to spend a few days with Olson and see his operation in an attempt to learn more about one of the most misunderstood gases in the universe. I arrived in Stockholm in mid-November and took a train to an industrial co-working space on the outskirts of town. Through the windows of a cavernous lobby, the sunlight had a kind of slant to it. Ominous clouds gathered, and the air was thick with the heavy feeling that precedes a long winter. Olson showed up exactly on time, took a seat across from me, and placed a glass on the table. He wore faded jeans, tennis shoes, and a pressed white shirt. He had that kind of calm you see in monks or Amish or others who spend a lot of time in their inner worlds. When he spoke, it was always softly, with that annoying habit that all Scandinavians seem to have inherited, flawless English, with no ums or huhs or pauses. He'd even gotten his whoms down and inserted the oft-forgotten not when he told me how he could care less. "I was going to end up exactly like my father," Olson said, running a finger along the glass. He told me how his father had been chronically stressed, how he breathed too much, how he'd gotten severe high blood pressure and lung disease and died at 68 with a tube in his mouth. "I knew that so many other people were going to stay sick and die of the same thing," Olson explained. He wanted to educate himself so that he'd be prepared if something else happened to him or his family. After the long days he spent running a software distribution company, Olson came home and read medical books. He'd call up doctors, surgeons, and scientists. Eventually, he sold his business, got rid of his nice cars and big house, got a divorce, and moved into a condominium. Then he scaled down to a smaller apartment and spent 6 years forgoing any salary, working almost entirely alone, trying to understand the mysteries of health and medicine and the role of carbon dioxide in the body. There were yogi books about prana, and then there were medical books focusing on pathologies, blood gases, and disease, and CPAP, he told me. In short, Olson had found what I'd found, but years earlier, that there was a gap in our knowledge about the science of breathing and its role in our bodies. He discovered we'd done a good job of examining what causes breathing problems, but done little to explore how they first develop and how we might prevent them. Doctors had been complaining about this for decades. The field of respiratory physiology is expanding in all directions, yet so preoccupied have most physiologists been with lung volumes, ventilation, circulation, gas exchange, the mechanics of breathing, the metabolic cost of breathing, and the control of breathing, that few have paid much attention to the muscles that actually do the breathing, one physician wrote in 1958. What many of these doctors found, what Olson would discover much later, was that the best way to prevent many chronic health problems, improve athletic performance, and extend longevity was to focus on how we breathe, specifically to balance oxygen and carbon dioxide levels in the body. To do this, we need to learn how to inhale and exhale slowly. How could inhaling smaller amounts of air and having more CO2 in our bloodstream increase oxygen in our tissues and organs? How could doing less give us more? To understand this contrarian concept, you need to consider the body parts beyond the nose and mouth. The purpose of those 25,000 inhales and exhales we take daily lies deeper inside of us. And the farther we follow this air, the more surprising and strange this journey gets. Your body, like all human bodies, is essentially a collection of tubes. There are wide tubes, like the throat and sinuses, and very thin tubes, like the capillaries. The tubes that make up the tissues in the lungs are very small, and we've got a ton of them. If you line them all up, they'd reach from New York City to Key West, more than 1,500 miles. Each breath you take must travel down the throat, past the crossroads called the tracheal carina, then splits into the right and left lungs. As it keeps going, that breath gets pushed into smaller tubes until it dead ends at little bulbs called alveoli. What happens next is very complicated and confusing. An analogy might help. Let's say you're about to take a river cruise. You're in a waiting room at the dock when a ship arrives. You pass through security, board the ship, and head off. This is similar to the path oxygen molecules take once they reach the alveoli. Each alveolus functions as a little docking station for each molecule of oxygen. As the O2 passes through the alveolus walls, it lodges into a red blood cell, a kind of cruise ship that carries it off deeper into the body. This cruise ship is filled with its own guest rooms. In your blood cells, those rooms are the protein called hemoglobin. As blood flows through the tissues and muscles, oxygen will disembark while another passenger will board. That passenger is carbon dioxide. Once filled, the red blood cell will begin its journey back to the lungs. This exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide changes the appearance of blood. Blood with more CO2 in it will appear blue. Blood still filled with oxygen will appear red. It's these gases that give veins and arteries their distinctive colors. Eventually, the cruise ship will make its round around the body and back to port, back to those lungs, where all the carbon dioxide will exit and new oxygen passengers will board. Then the process starts all over again. Every healthy cell in the body is fueled by oxygen, and this is how it's delivered. The entire cruise takes about a minute, and the overall numbers are staggering. Inside each of our 25 trillion red blood cells are 270 million hemoglobin, each of which has room for 4 oxygen molecules. That's a billion molecules of O2 boarding and disembarking within each red blood cell cruise ship. There's nothing controversial about this process of respiration and the role of carbon dioxide and gas exchange. This is all basic biochemistry. What's less acknowledged is the role of carbon dioxide in weight loss. That CO2 we release with every breath has weight, and we exhale more weight than we inhale. The way the body loses weight isn't through profusely sweating or burning it off. We lose weight through exhaled breath. For every 10 pounds of fat lost in our bodies, 8.5 pounds comes off through the lungs. The rest is sweated or urinated out. This is a fact most doctors, nutritionists, and other medical professionals have historically gotten wrong. The lungs are the weight-regulating system of the body.
Everyone always talks about oxygen, Olsen told me during our interview in Stockholm. Whether we breathe 30 times or 5 times a minute, a healthy body will always have enough oxygen.
What our bodies really want, what they require to function properly, isn't faster or deeper breaths. It's not more air. What we need is more carbon dioxide. More than a century ago, a baggy-eyed Danish physiologist named Christian Bohr discovered this in a laboratory in Copenhagen. Bohr was fascinated with respiration. He knew that oxygen was the cellular fuel and that hemoglobin was the transporter. He knew that when oxygen went into a cell, carbon dioxide came out. But Bohr didn't know why this exchange took place. Why did some cells get more O2 more easily than others? What directed billions of hemoglobin molecules to release oxygen at just the right place at just the right time? How did breathing really work? He began experimenting. Bohr gathered chickens, guinea pigs, grass snakes, dogs, horses, and more, and he measured how much oxygen the animals consumed, how much carbon dioxide they produced. Then he drew blood and exposed it to different mixtures of these gases. Blood with the most CO2 in it loosened oxygen from hemoglobin. In some ways, carbon dioxide worked as a kind of divorce lawyer, a go-between to separate oxygen from its ties so it could be free. This discovery explained why certain muscles used during exercise receive more oxygen than lesser-used muscles. They were producing more CO2, which attracted more oxygen. It was a supply and demand on a molecular level. Carbon dioxide also had a profound dilating effect on blood vessels, opening these pathways so they could carry more blood to hungry cells. Breathing less allowed animals to produce more energy more efficiently. Meanwhile, just a few moments of heavy breathing above our metabolic needs could reduce blood flow. We'll feel lightheaded, cramp up, get a headache, and even black out. If our tissues were denied constant flow for too long, they'd break down. In 1904, Bohr published a paper about all this. It was a sensation among scientists and inspired a flurry of new research into carbon dioxide. Soon after, a Yale physiologist named Yandell Henderson began his own set of experiments. Henderson, too, had spent the last several years studying metabolism, and like Bohr, he was convinced that CO2 was as essential to the body as any vitamin. Although clinicians still find it hard to believe, oxygen is in no sense a stimulant to living creatures, Henderson would write. If a fire is supplied with pure oxygen instead of air, it burns with enormously augmented intensity. But when a man or animal breathes oxygen or air enriched with oxygen, no more of that gas is consumed. No more heat is produced, and no more carbon dioxide is exhaled than when air alone is breathed. For a healthy body, overbreathing or inhaling pure oxygen would have no benefit, no effect on oxygen delivery to tissues and organs, and could actually create a state of deficiency. In other words, the pure O2 a quarterback might huff between plays, or that a jet-lagged traveler might shell out $50 for at an airport oxygen bar, don't do anything. Inhaling the gas might increase blood O2 levels 1 or 2%, but that oxygen will never make it to hungry cells. We'll simply breathe it back out. To prove his point, over the years, Henderson conducted a number of awful experiments on dogs that are about as difficult to read as Harvard's awful experiments on monkeys. For people sensitive to this kind of thing, you might want to forward the next 2 minutes. Henderson placed individual dogs on a table, fitting their faces with a rubber mask. At the end of the tube was a hand bellows. The contraption allowed Henderson to control how much air each dog took in and how often. A suite of instruments recorded heart rate, carbon dioxide, oxygen, and more. As Henderson pumped the bellows faster and faster, he watched the heart rates of the animals quickly increase from 40 up to 200 beats a minute. The dogs would eventually have so much oxygen flowing through their arteries, with so little carbon dioxide to offload it, that their bodies began failing. Dogs would spasm uncontrollably or drift into a coma. If Henderson kept pumping more air, the animals would become so full of O2 and so deficient of CO2 that they died. Henderson killed dogs with their own breath. With the dogs that survived, he would pump the bellows a little slower and watch as their heart rates immediately decreased to 40 beats per minute. It wasn't the act of breathing that sped up and slowed the dogs' hearts. It was the amount of carbon dioxide flowing through their bloodstream. Henderson then forced the dogs to breathe just slightly harder than normal, just above their metabolic needs. This was a condition of mild hyperventilation common in humans. The dogs grew agitated, confused, anxious, and glassy-eyed. The slight overbreathing was inducing the same confused state that occurred during altitude sickness or panic attacks. Henderson gave the dogs morphine and other drugs to slow their heart rates. These drugs worked partly because, as Henderson observed, they helped raise carbon dioxide levels. But there was another way to restore the animals to health. Let them breathe slowly. Whenever Henderson lowered the breathing rates, all that twitching, the stupors, the anxiety went away. The dogs stretched out and relaxed, their muscles loosened, and a peacefulness washed over them. Carbon dioxide is the chief hormone of the entire body. It is the only one that is produced by every tissue and that probably acts on every organ, Henderson later wrote. Carbon dioxide is, in fact, a more fundamental component of living matter than is oxygen. I spent 3 days with Olson in Stockholm. We pored over tables and graphs and talked about Bohr and Henderson and other storied pulmonauts. By the end of my trip, I finally understood how my own view of breathing had been so limited and so wrong for so many years. And I finally understood how Olson had become so obsessed with this line of research, how he'd given up his life as a software tycoon and downgraded to such a tiny apartment, why he'd spent so many months recording breathing techniques, how they affected his blood pressure and energy and stress levels. I understood why only one person showed up for the first conference he held in 2010, and why after honing his message and building his research base, he was now something of a Swedish media star, his grinning, perpetually tanned, rom-com face showing up in newspapers, magazines, and nightly news shows. In these interviews, he beseeched audiences with the same message of slow breathing. I returned home to San Francisco, and Olson and I kept in touch. Every few weeks, I get a new email or a call about some long-lost scientific discovery he'd just unearthed. He'd continued his self-experimentation, too, always seeking to use his own body to prove the power of breathing and the wonders of that metabolic waste product, carbon dioxide. This is how Olson ended up, a year later, in my living room in San Francisco with a face mask velcroed to his head and an electrode clipped to his ear. "Can you hand me the oximeter, please?" Olson says from across the table. We've just finished our afternoon testing, and Olson is re-strapping himself into the Breath IQ, a prototype of a device that measures CO2, ammonia, and other elements in exhaled breath. He clips a pulse oximeter to his finger and starts counting down the seconds. Maybe it's the carbon dioxide and the nitric oxide boost from nasal breathing, but we're feeling punchy today. In addition to the 5 grand we dropped on x-rays and pulmonary tests at Stanford, Olson and I also managed to amass several $1,000s worth of equipment at our own home lab. We've spent 2 weeks running tests and have yet to push the throttle on it. That's changing today. Olson wipes a hand on his Abercrombie sweatshirt and scoots over so that I can see the readouts on the machines. All vitals are normal. Heart rate, around 75. Blood pressure, around 126. Oxygen levels, at 97. 3, 2, 1, he begins breathing. But slowly, very slowly. He inhales and exhales about 3 times slower than that of the average American, turning those 18 breaths a minute into just 6. As he sips air through his nose and out through his mouth, I watch as his carbon dioxide levels rise. They keep rising.
A minute later, Olson's levels are 25% higher than they were just a few minutes ago. All the while, his blood pressure drops and his heart rate sinks to the mid-60s. What hasn't changed is his oxygen. From start to finish, even though he's breathing at a third of the rate of what's considered normal, his oxygen levels have stayed the same, steady at 97%. We've experienced the same confounding measurements during our bike workouts earlier in the week. The beginning of these workouts, like all workouts, sucked. We felt our lungs desperately trying to meet the needs of our hungry tissues and muscles. This is the dinner rush of the body. Normally, I'd open my mouth and huff and puff, trying to sate that nagging need. But for the last several days, I cranked the pedals harder and faster while I forced myself to breathe slower and slower. This felt stifling and claustrophobic, like I was starving myself of fuel. But then I checked the pulse oximeter. Once again, no matter how slowly I breathed or how hard I pedaled, my oxygen levels stayed steady. It turns out that when breathing at a normal rate, our lungs will absorb only about a quarter of the available O2 in the air. The majority of that oxygen is exhaled back out. By taking longer breaths, we allow our lungs to soak up more with less. On the second day of using the slower nasal breathing approach, I'd outdistanced my mouth breathing record by a 13th of a mile. The next session, I pedaled a 5% increase over mouth breathing. By my fifth ride on the stationary bike, I pedaled 7.7 miles, almost a full mile longer in the same amount of time, using the same amount of energy than I had previously in the week. This was a significant gain. During that ride, I started playing around with my breathing. I tried to inhale and exhale even slower and slower. I immediately felt that sense of air hunger and claustrophobia. I looked down at the pulse oximeter to see just how much oxygen I was losing, how starved my body had become. But my oxygen levels hadn't decreased with these slow breaths as I or as anyone else might expect. They kept rising. A last word on slow breathing. It goes by another name, prayer. When Buddhist monks chant their most popular mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, each spoken phrase lasts 6 seconds, with 6 seconds to inhale before the chant starts over again. The traditional chant of Om takes 6 seconds to sing, with a pause of about 6 seconds to inhale. The Satanama chant, one of the best-known techniques in Kundalini Yoga, takes about 6 seconds to vocalize, followed by 6 seconds to inhale. Japanese, African, Hawaiian, Native American, Buddhist, Taoist, Christian, all these cultures and all these religions had somehow developed the same prayer techniques, requiring the same breathing pattern, and they all benefited from the same calming effect. In 2001, researchers at the University of Pavia in Italy gathered 24 subjects, covered them with sensors to measure blood flow, heart rate, nervous system feedback. Then they had them recite a Buddhist mantra, as well as the original Latin version of the Ave Maria. The researchers were stunned to find that the average number of breaths for each cycle was almost exactly identical, just a bit quicker than the pace of those Hindus, Taoists, and Native American prayers. It was 5.5 breaths a minute. But what was even more stunning was what breathing like this did to the subjects. Whenever they followed this pattern, blood flow to the brain increased and the systems of the body entered a state of coherence, where the heart, circulation, and nervous system are coordinated to peak efficiency. The moment the subjects returned to spontaneous breathing or talking, their heart rates would beat a little more erratically, and the integration of these systems would slowly fall apart. A few more slow and relaxed breaths, and it would return again. A decade after the Pavia test, two renowned professors and doctors in New York, Patricia Gerberg and Richard Brown, used the same breathing pattern on patients with anxiety and depression, minus the praying. Some of these patients had trouble breathing this slowly, so Gerberg and Brown recommended they start with an easier rhythm of just 3-second inhales with at least the same length exhale. As the patients got more comfortable, they breathed in and breathed out longer. It turns out that the most efficient breathing rhythm for the body occurs when both the length of respirations and the total breaths per minute are locked in a spooky symmetry. 5.5 second inhales followed by 5.5 second exhales, which works out almost exactly to 5.5 breaths per minute. Even when practiced for just 5 or 10 minutes a day, the results can be potent. I've seen patients transformed by adopting regular breathing practices, said Brown. He and Gerbarg even used the slow breathing technique to restore the lungs of 9/11 survivors who suffered from a chronic cough caused by debris. There was no known cure for this ailment, and yet after just 2 months, patients achieved a significant improvement by simply learning to practice a few rounds of slow breathing. Did it matter if we breathed at a rate of 5 or 6 seconds or were a half second off? It did not, as long as the breaths were in the range of 5.5. In many ways, the resonant breathing offered the same benefits of meditation for people who didn't want to meditate, or yoga for people who didn't want to get off the couch. It offered the healing touch of prayer for people who weren't religious. The Pavia researchers wrote, "We believe that the rosary may have partly evolved because it synchronized with the inherent cardiovascular Mayer rhythms and thus gave a feeling of well-being and perhaps an increased responsiveness to the religious message." In other words, the meditations, Ave Marias, and dozens of other prayers that have been developed over the past thousands of years weren't all baseless. Prayer really heals, especially when it's practiced at 5.5 breaths a minute. Chapter 6. Less. Few would dispute we become a culture of overeaters. From around 1850 to 1960, the American Mean Body Mass Index, a measurement of fat based on height, was between 20 and 22. That's about 160 pounds for a 6-foot-tall person. Today, the average BMI is 29. That 6-foot-tall person now weighs 214 pounds. 70% of the U.S. population is considered overweight. 1 in 3 are obese. There's no doubt we're eating more than we did in the past. Rates of breathing are much more difficult to gauge because there are fewer studies and the results are inconsistent. Nonetheless, a review of the available research offers a troubling picture. What's considered medically normal today is anywhere between a dozen and 20 breaths a minute, with an average intake of about 0.5 liter per breath. For those on the high end of the respiratory rates, that's about twice as much as it was. One thing that every medical or freelance pulmonaut I've talked to in the past several years has told me is that just as we become a culture of overeaters, we've also become a culture of overbreathers. Most of us breathe too much, and up to a quarter of us suffer from serious chronic overbreathing. The fix is easy. Breathe less. But that's harder than it sounds. We become conditioned to breathe too much just as we become conditioned to eat too much. With some effort and training, however, breathing less can become an unconscious habit. Indian yogis train themselves to decrease the amount of air they take at rest, not increase it. Tibetan Buddhists prescribe step-by-step instructions to reduce and calm breathing for aspiring monks. Chinese doctors 2,000 years ago advised 13,500 breaths per day, which works out to about 9.5 breaths per minute. They likely breathed less in those fewer breaths. In Japan, legend has it the samurai would test a soldier's readiness by placing a feather beneath his nostrils while he inhaled and exhaled. If the feather moved, the soldier would be dismissed. To be clear, breathing less is not the same as breathing slowly. Average adult lungs can hold about 4 to 6 liters, which means that if we practice slow breathing at 5.5 breaths per minute, we could still be taking in twice the air we need. The key to optimum breathing and all the health, endurance, and longevity benefits that come with it is to practice fewer inhales and exhales in a smaller volume. To breathe, but to breathe less. With only 4 days left in the Stanford experiment, I was reaping the benefits of slowing my respiratory rate. My blood pressure kept dropping, my heart rate variability kept rising, and I had more energy than I knew what to do with. All the while, Olson kept prodding me to reduce my breathing rate even further. He harped on about the wonders of breathing way less than anyone normally should, the respiratory equivalent of fasting. Now, starving yourself of air can be bad if it becomes a regular thing. Ordinarily, we should breathe as closely in line with our needs as we can, but occasionally willing the body to breathe way less has some potent benefits, just as fasting does. Sometimes, Olson told me, it can lead to euphoria. It was a better feeling than when I got married, better than when my first child was born, he says. It's morning, and we're driving past the ragged waves along Highway 1. I'm at the wheel, and Olson is beside me on the passenger seat. He's smiling broadly, reliving the moment 5 years ago when he saw God. I ran for an hour or so, 6 miles, I think, and I came home and sat in my living room chair. His voice here is quivering a little. He's almost laughing. And I had this dull headache, that good headache, and I felt the most intense peace and unity in the world. Everything. Our destination today is Golden Gate Park, which offers miles of uninterrupted jogging tracks beneath canopies of blue gum eucalyptus. Because the tracks are dirt, we won't split our heads open and die if we suddenly go unconscious. This is a rare but real side effect of this breathing way less thing we'll be attempting. Olson swears by this approach. He and his clients have reported profound improvements in endurance and well-being after just a few weeks. However, I've heard from many others it could be miserable and might induce vicious headaches, not those good ones. It wasn't for dabblers. I turn the car from the freeway and park beside the lot of the Golden Gate Casting Club. A herd of buffalo behind a chain-link fence stare with bored eyes as Olson and I slip off our jackets, take a few last swigs of water, lock the car, and hit the ground running. To be clear, I hate jogging. Unlike other physical activities like surfing or swimming, whenever I jog, I'm fully conscious of the misery and boredom of every second. I've never reached that spaced-out runner's high, even though, years back, I put in 4-mile runs every other day. The benefits of jogging were obvious. I always felt great afterwards. But doing it was a grind. Olson wanted to change my mind. He's been jogging for decades and has trained dozens of runners. The key is to find a rhythm that works for you, he tells me as we beeline into the bramble. You should challenge yourself, but at the same time, don't overdo it. The trail splits off, and we follow the path less traveled. The sun shines through the skyscraper trees, and there's musty spearmint in the air. I listen to the sound of footfalls crunching on crispy leaves. It's nice. What I want you to do is, as you warm up, start extending your exhales, Olson tells me. Each breath we draw in should take about 3 seconds, and each breath out should take about 4. We'll continue the same short inhale, longer exhale pattern, but extend those exhales to 5, 6, or 7 counts as we run further. These slower, longer exhales, of course, mean higher carbon dioxide levels. With that bonus CO2, we can gain a higher aerobic endurance. Training the body to breathe less actually increases the amount of oxygen we can consume, which can not only boost stamina, but also help us live longer and healthier lives. The godfather of this less-is-more approach was a Polmonaut born in 1923 on a grubby farm outside of Kiev in what is now Ukraine. His name was Konstantin Buteyko, and he spent his youth examining the world around him. Anything, really. Plants, insects, toys, and cars. He came to view the world as a mechanism, and everything within it as a collection of parts locking together to form a greater whole. By the time he was a teenager, Buteyko had developed into a brilliant mechanic and would later spend 4 years on the front lines of World War II fixing cars, tanks, and artillery. When the war ended, I decided to start researching the most complex machine, the man, Buteyko would write. I thought, if I learned him, I'd be able to diagnose his diseases as easily as I had diagnosed machine disorders. Buteyko went on to attend the first Moscow Institute of Medicine, the most prestigious medical school in the Soviet Union. He graduated cum laude. During his residency rounds, he noticed the patients in the worst health all seemed to breathe far too much. The more they breathed, the worse off they were, especially those with hypertension. Buteyko himself had suffered from severe high blood pressure, along with the headaches and heart pain that came with it. He'd been put on prescription drugs to no effect. When he was 29, his systolic blood pressure had shot up to 212, a dangerously high number. Doctors gave him a year to live. "One can avoid cancer by cutting it out," Buteyko would later say, "but you can't avoid hypertension." The best he could do for his patients and for himself was to try to numb the symptoms. As the story goes, one night in October, Buteyko was standing alone in a hospital room, looking out from a window into a black autumn sky. He turned his focus on the reflection in the glass, a gaunt and haggard face drawing heavy breaths through an open mouth. His eyes roamed down to the white robe covering his chest, to his shoulders flexing and lifting with each labored inhale and exhale. This was the same respiratory rate he'd seen in terminally ill patients. Buteyko wasn't exercising, and yet he was breathing as if he'd just finished a workout. He tried an experiment. He started breathing less, to relax his chest and stomach and sip air through his nose. A few minutes later, the throbbing pain in his head and heart disappeared. Buteyko returned to the heavy breathing he'd been doing minutes earlier. Within 5 inhales, all that pain returned. What if overbreathing wasn't the result of hypertension and headaches, but the cause, Buteyko wondered? Heart disease, ulcers, chronic inflammation, all of them were linked to disturbances in circulation and blood pH. How we breathe affects those things. Breathing just 20% or even 10% more than the body's needs could overwork our systems. Eventually, they'd falter. Was breathing too much making people sick and keeping them that way? Buteyko took a walk. In the asthma ward, he found a man stooped over, fighting suffocation, gasping for air. Buteyko approached and showed him the technique he'd just been using. After a few minutes, the patient calmed. He inhaled a careful and clear breath through his nose and then exhaled. Suddenly, his face was flushed with color. The asthma attack was over. Back in Golden Gate Park, Olson and I are jogging deeper into the foot trail. The bucolic scene of dappled sunlight and avatar trees has morphed into a more urban mess of shopping carts and suspicious mounds of toilet paper. We realize the path less traveled may be less traveled for a reason. A quick left, and we're on our way back to the coastal route. We jog past an old hippie sitting on a tree stump playing the Jeopardy theme song on a trumpet with one hand and reading a dog-eared paperback with the other. In front of him, an impeccably dressed man goads an old dog into a beat-up Mercedes, and a woman with waist-length dreadlocks and Mork from Ork suspenders whizzes by on an electric scooter. It's a quintessentially San Francisco scene, and Olson and I fit right in. We've been practicing an extreme version of the techniques Buteyko used in the asthma ward, limiting our inhales while extending exhales far past the point of what feels comfortable or even safe. We're sweating and we're red-faced, and I can feel the veins bulging in my neck. I'm not exactly out of breath, but I don't feel satisfied either. Even when I sip a little more air, I feel like I'm being mildly strangled. The point of this exercise isn't to inflict pain. It's to get the body comfortable with higher levels of carbon dioxide so that we'll unconsciously breathe less during our resting hours, so that we'll release more oxygen, increase our endurance, and better support all the functions of our bodies. "Try to extend the exhales even more," Olson says as he takes a tiny nip of air through his nose. "Breathe out twice as long for each exhale, 3 times," he chides me. For a moment, I feel like I'm going to puke. "Yes," he says, "even slower, even less." By the late 1950s, Buteyko left the Moscow hospitals and headed to Akademgorodok,
a research facility located in central Siberia. The distant location was by design. For the past few years, the Soviet government had sent tens of thousands of the finest space engineers, physicists, and others to live in secrecy among the laboratories. Their job was to develop cutting-edge technologies aimed at ensuring dominance. In many ways, it was a Soviet Silicon Valley, but without the fleece vests, without the kombucha, the sunshine, Teslas, and civil liberties. Buteyko had moved there at the request of the USSR Academy of Medical Sciences, the equivalent of the CDC. After his epiphany in the asthma ward, he'd pored over research papers and analyzed hundreds of patients. He'd become convinced that breathing too much was the culprit behind several chronic diseases. Like Bohr and Henderson before him, Buteyko was fascinated with carbon dioxide. He too believed that increasing this gas by breathing less could not only keep us fit and healthy, it could heal us as well. At Akadem Gorodok, he set out to conduct the most exhaustive breathing experiments that science had ever attempted. He collected a staff of more than 200 researchers in a sweeping city hospital. Subjects would come in and lie on a gurney sandwiched between stacks of machines. Phlebotomists would plug catheters into their veins while other researchers stuck hoses into their throats and electrodes around their heart and head. As the subjects breathed in and out, a primitive computer recorded 100,000 bits of data per hour. The sick and healthy, the young and old, more than 1,000 of them came to Buteyko's lab. Those patients with asthma or hypertension and other ailments consistently breathed the same, too much. They'd inhale and exhale through the mouth, packing in 15 liters or more of air per minute. The readouts showed that they had plenty of oxygen in their blood, but much less carbon dioxide. Resting heart rates were up to 90 beats per minute. Meanwhile, the healthiest patients breathed alike too. Less. They'd inhale and exhale about 10 times a minute, taking in a total of about 5 to 6 liters of air. Their resting pulses ranged from around 48 to 55, and they had about 50% more carbon dioxide in their exhaled breath. Buteyko developed a protocol based on the breathing habits of these healthy patients, which he later called voluntary elimination of deep breathing. The techniques were many, and they varied, but the purpose of each was to train patients to always breathe as closely as possible to their metabolic needs, which almost always meant taking in less air. How many breaths we took per minute, that was less important to Buteyko, as long as we were breathing no more than about 6 liters per minute at rest. Within a few sessions of practicing these techniques, patients reported tingling and heat in their hands and toes. Their heart rates would slow and stabilize. The hypertension and migraines that had debilitated so many of them for so many years all began to disappear. Those already in good health felt even better. Athletes claimed big gains in performance. At around the same time, 1,000 miles east, in the industrial factory town of Zlin, Czechoslovakia, a gangly runner by the name of Emil Zatopek was experimenting with his own breath restriction techniques. Zatopek never wanted to become a runner. When the management at the shoe factory he was working at elected him for a local race, he tried to refuse. Zatopek told them he was unfit, that he had no interest, and that he'd never run in a competition. But he ran anyway and came in second out of 100 contestants. Zatopek saw a brighter future for himself in running, began to take the sport more seriously. 4 years later, he broke 3 national records. He developed his own training methods to give himself an edge. He'd run as fast as he could while holding his breath, take a few huffs and puffs, then do it all over again. It was an extreme version of Buteyko's methods, but Zatopek didn't call it voluntary elimination of deep breathing. Nobody did. It would be called hypoventilation training. Hypo, which comes from the Greek for under, as in hypodermic needle, is the opposite of hyper, meaning over. The concept of hypoventilation was to breathe less. Over the years, Zatopek's approach was widely derided and mocked, but he ignored everybody. The 1952 Olympics, he won gold in the 5,000 and 10,000 meters. On the heels of his success, he decided to compete in the marathon, an event he had never trained for or run in his life. He won gold. Zatopek would claim 18 world records, 4 Olympic golds, and a silver over his career. He would later be named the greatest runner of all time by Runner's World magazine.
"He does everything wrong but win," said Larry Snyder, a track coach at the time.
Hypoventilation training didn't exactly take off after those Olympics. Zatopek's anguished face, his teeth grinding and eyes wincing like a Matthias Grunewald Jesus, became his trademark look as he crossed the finish line, often in first place. It all seemed miserable because it was. Most athletes steered clear. Then, decades later, in the 1970s, a hard-ass U.S. swim coach named James Councilman rediscovered it. Councilman was notorious for his pain-based training techniques. Hypoventilation fit right in. Usually, competitive swimmers take about 2 or 3 strokes before they flip their heads to the side and inhale. Councilman trained his team to hold their breath for as many as 9 strokes. He believed that, over time, the swimmers could utilize oxygen more efficiently and swim faster. In a sense, it was Buteyko's breathing, but underwater. Councilman used these techniques to train the U.S. men's swimming team for the Montreal Olympics. They won 13 gold medals, 14 silver, and 7 bronze, and they set world records in 11 events. It was the greatest performance by a swim team in history. Hypoventilation training fell back into obscurity after several studies in the 80s argued it had little or no impact on performance and endurance. Whatever these athletes were gaining, researchers reported, must have been a strong placebo effect. Then, in the early 2000s, Dr. Xavier Warrens, a French physiologist, found a flaw in these studies. The scientists critical of the technique had measured it all wrong. They'd been looking at athletes holding their breath with full lungs, and all that extra air in the lungs made it difficult for them to enter a deep state of hypoventilation. Warrens repeated the test, but this time subjects practiced with a half-full technique, which is how Buteyko trained his patients, and likely how Councilman trained his swimmers. Breathing less offered huge benefits. Reports showed that hypoventilation provided a huge boost in red blood cells, allowing athletes to carry more oxygen and produce more energy with each breath. It was essentially high-altitude training, but it could be used anywhere. Over the years, the style of breath restriction has been given many names: hypoventilation, hypoxic therapy, Buteyko technique, and the pointlessly technical normobaric hypoxia training. The outcomes were the same, a profound boost in performance, and it wasn't just for elite athletes either. A few weeks of training this way increased endurance, reduced fat, improved cardiovascular function, boosted muscle mass, and more compared to normal breathing exercise. The list goes on and on. The takeaway is that hypoventilation works. It trains the body to do more with less, but that doesn't mean it's pleasant. Olson and I emerged from the shady tranquility of Golden Gate Park, stopping to face the wind-ripped Pacific Ocean. We've just jogged a few miles, inhaling fast and exhaling very long breaths to a count of 7 or more. We're trying to keep our lungs roughly half full. I want to believe that this training will be helping me, just as it helped Zatopek, Councilman swimmers, Warren's runners, and everybody else. But the past several minutes have been a challenge. "The key is to find a rhythm that works for you," Olson keeps saying. The rhythm is definitely not working. I return to my more manageable practice, inhaling for 2 steps and exhaling for 5. This isn't exactly comfortable, but it's tolerable. We run across the cracked asphalt of a beachside parking lot, passing a few rusting Winnebagos and hopping over smashed cans of malt liquor. Then we head back across the highway. 20 minutes later, we're in the quietude of the park, treading a dirt path beneath an understory of trees. That's when it hits me. an intense heat at the back of my neck, and pixelated vision. I'm still jogging, exhaling long breaths, but it feels as though I'm simultaneously jumping headfirst in a warm liquid. It feels great. I run a little harder, breathe a little less, feel a little more heat. It's heavy, like hot syrup seeping down into my fingertips and toes. It moves higher through my face and wraps around the crown of my head. This must be the good headache Olson keeps talking about. Of all the carbon dioxide increasing and oxygen dislodging into my hungry cells, of all those vessels in my brain and body becoming so engorged with blood that they're sending dull pain signals to my nervous system. Just when it feels like I'm about to reach some kind of existential crescendo, the little foot trail widens. The bored buffalo appear rustling behind a chain-link fence. A dozen yards away is the lot at the Golden Gate Casting Club. My car is beside it, and we're done. There are no huge life epiphanies as we drive home. I can't say I'm feeling euphoric, but that's okay. My little jog proved there's much to gain from this less approach. At the same time, such extreme training would be useful only for those willing to endure so many hours of red-faced and sweaty suffering. Healthy breathing shouldn't be so much work. Buteyko knew this, and he rarely, if ever, prescribed such brutal methods. After all, he wasn't interested in coaching elite athletes to win gold medals. He wanted to save lives. He wanted to teach techniques that could be practiced by everyone, regardless of their state of health, age, or level of fitness. Over his career, Buteyko would be censured by medical critics. He'd be physically attacked and at one point have his laboratory torn up. But he pressed on. By the 80s, he had published more than 50 scientific papers, and the Soviet Ministry of Health had recognized his techniques as effective. Some 200,000 people in Russia alone had learned his methods. Buteyko allegedly was once invited to England to meet with Prince Charles, who was suffering from allergies. Buteyko helped the prince, and he helped heal upwards of 80% of his other patients suffering from hypertension and arthritis and other ailments. Breathing less, he found, was especially effective in treating respiratory diseases. It seemed to work like a miracle for asthma. In the decades since Buteyko first started training patients, asthma has become a global epidemic. Nearly 25 million Americans now suffer from it. That's about 8% of the total population, and a fourfold increase from the 80s. It is the leading cause of emergency room visits,